This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along. It's another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is where we take a quick flick through the universe to learn about the most amazing and dangerous things that's happening inside. And it's the last edition of 2018. What a speedy year. Crammed, jam-packed full of some amazing discoveries and some wondrous things. So I thought we'd take a look at some of the best discoveries that we've made, the smartest experts that we've chatted to, and the most dangerous stuff that we've faced in the last year. So this week, we'll talk about a mash of two incredible creatures in the world. Also, we'll learn about a way that drones are helping to save our planet, and we start with diving into the history of bugs. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, our guest today can tell us about some of the most annoying, frustrating, but also interesting creatures in the whole world and throughout history. Christopher Lloyd is the creator of Explorer Bugs. It's been made in association with the Natural History Museum. It charts the history of bugs from 500 million years ago right through to today. First question, what's the earliest bug that we know about, and what evidence do we have of its existence?
When you go back 500 million years ago, all life is in the sea. And if you were to dive down into the sea about that time, you would find some really extraordinary creatures, things unlike anything that is alive today. And some of the most interesting of these are the ancestors of bugs. And I think probably the most significant is the trilobite. Now, these are fossils that are quite common throughout the world, but trilobites first appear about 530 million years ago. And they look like beetles, and they could sometimes typically grow about the size of your thumb, but sometimes it could grow as big as a metre. And the amazing thing about trilobites is thought that they're the first creatures to have been able to see. Now, this changes everything at the bottom of the sea. Because if you imagine all creatures being blind, they have to fumble around in the dark to find food. Imagine that you suddenly have developed this amazing technology called eyesight, which means that you can actually target things. So other creatures have to find new strategies to survive, like camouflage. You see, there'll be no such thing as camouflage without eyesight. And that's why worms now bury themselves in the ground so they could avoid being eaten by the trilobites with their eyesight. And other creatures develop shells like mollusks and mussels and oysters and clams so that their soft bodies would be protected from creatures with eyes, i.e. trilobites, the ancestral arthropod or bug, that could target them with this amazing technology under the sea. So to my mind, you know, you go back that far and suddenly you begin to see it. This is the tip of the iceberg of the most amazing story.
So they're very useful as well, just from 500 million years ago when they first developed sight right through to today. They help pollinate fruits and plants. How else do they keep our environment in tip-top working condition?
Of course, they're not just useful to humans. I mean, if you think about it, what would the world be like without honey and without honeybees? Bees have influenced ancient civilizations all the way from the Egyptians. And many of the things you see in human civilizations were actually pioneered 100 million years ago in the world of insects. They teach each other how to do things. They guard their nests. Some of them are soldiers. Some of them are workers. Some of them reproduce. They divide labor up into different things, just like we do in our cities today. And so actually, many of the cultures that you think are unique to humans are not unique to humans at all. They first started in the world of insects.
And it's not just their intelligence and their usefulness. I'd imagine something brilliant about bugs is their staying power. If you think when many creatures have come and gone, we've had whole ranges of huge reptiles that ruled the world, and then they were extinct with a massive meteor, some volcanoes, loads of ash, killed them off. Why are the bugs staying here? What increases their staying power?
That's a brilliant question. When life gets tough, it's good to be small. That's basically the tip. If you're a giant great Diplodocus and something happens in the environment, you're a lot more vulnerable than if you're an ant. Because ants can hide, ants can burrow away. They don't need much food for survival. If the world goes dark, they'll find some litter around or they'll find something that they can eat. And there have been five mass extinctions in the history of the world. The worst was 252 million years ago. The most recent was the one that killed off the dinosaurs 65.5 million years ago. Every time it's been good to be small. because and bugs are, they are small, except when you get to about 300 million years ago, you will find that actually bugs got very big. And there was an ancestral dragonfly called a griffinfly that could grow up to the size of an eagle. Can you imagine an eagle-sized dragonfly? They were very vicious, by the way. And there was a spider that could grow up to a metre wide. So actually, bugs haven't always been small. They've been big in ancient history or prehistory. And the reason is thought to be because oxygen levels were higher then. Because, you see, bugs don't have lungs and hearts to pump oxygen around their body. That's what allows mammals and reptiles and amphibians to get really big. They rely on the oxygen in the air to filter through little tubes. So if there's more oxygen in the air, like there was in those days, then they could grow much bigger. And as oxygen levels get lower, as they are today, then, of course, the insects have to grow smaller. But by being smaller, they're at an advantage because if catastrophe strikes, they've got a better chance of survival.
What else has stuck with them then? And how else have they changed? So if you say that they used to be much bigger than we imagine that they are now, what are the other constants that we see with bugs today?
If you imagine a typical fairy story, like, okay, like a frog turns into a prince. Now, the world of insects is much more amazing. A caterpillar turns into a butterfly. Now, I mean, that is truly stunning. How does a little worm-like creature that just lives on a leaf like that and then surrounds itself in this cocoon like a changing room, and then over 3 weeks it transforms itself into a creature that can fly with the most beautiful wings, and out it hatches and off it goes. And this is what developed in the world of bugs. And this idea of metamorphosis, of changing completely from one body form to another, was pioneered in the world of bugs millions and millions of years ago, and it's been so effective that bugs have kept this metamorphosis all the way through millions and millions of years to their huge advantage and their great credit.
I just want to touch on metamorphosis, specifically the butterfly. Evolutionary-wise, what's the point in that?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, the most important one is that, of course, it's to reproduce, because, of course, that caterpillar needs to find another creature of the opposite sex in order to be able to fertilize and have more offspring. And if it can do that by flying, it's got a much greater chance of being able to spread itself and the species and find a partner than if it's just crawling around on a leaf.
Tell us about the book then. It's Explorer Bugs. It's got this fantastic timeline in the back. That's not all though. You're the creator of these series of books. There are many more that we can pick up as well. Just give us a brief glimpse of what we can get inside.
Basically, when you open the first page, you will see that there is a character here called Agent Eagle, who it looks slightly like me, he's basically a librarian by day, but he's fascinated in discovering about real things that have happened in the past, and he's been sent on a mission by the Eagle-Eyed Explorer Club to find out everything about bugs. And you can follow his journal as he steps you through what a bug is and where they came from, all the way through to the most amazing bugs when they were the size of dragonflies and spiders a metre wide, all the way through to the evolution of bugs when plants came on the scene, and you have beetles and you have all sorts of insect civilizations, etc. And he charts it up in his notebook with lots of illustrations, lots of fascinating drawings, and ways in which you can become a world expert on bugs. And then by the time we get to see other bug explorers, which are all featured in his diary with a few quizzes and things at the end to check that you're now the world expert, you'll find there's a glossary in case you don't understand some of the terms, and an index if you want to look things up. And then at the end, you've got your fold-out timeline, and then you can spread it out on the floor. Several people can look at it at once or put it up on the wall, and hopefully you will see that this extraordinary story over 500 million years is something, you know, that we're surrounded by.
It's honestly one of the most, of all the books that have come through the Fun Kids studio, it's one of the ones that has caught my eye and filled my mind the most, I'd imagine. It's been created by Christopher Lloyd. It's called Explorer Bugs with the Natural History Museum. Christopher, thank you so much for coming.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, I got a few danger stands on the way this week to celebrate the most deadly things in the world for the end of the year. Now, every week on the show, we look at the most evil and mean things that exist. And here's what happens when you visit a planet where it rains glass. It's time for this week's Dangerous Stand then, the place where we talk about the most mean, cruel and deadly things in the whole universe. And today we're actually headed into space to go to a place where the rain falling from the sky would tear you to shreds. Because 63 light years away, you'll find a glorious blue planet. And it looks like a smooth marble drifting along the bottom of the ocean, where the blue on top shifts and swirls like the tide. This planet is called HD189773b. Sounds more like a robot's, an alien's phone number, doesn't it, than a planet? Anyway, it's about the size of Jupiter. So it's massive, but it's completely uninhabitable. You can't live there. Not just because it's so close to its own sun that the temperatures soar to around 1,700 degrees. Not only as the violent heat causes winds of 4,000 miles an hour to blister along the surface. You can't live there because it rains glass. Molten glass falls from the sky. But because of the winds and how fast they are, it doesn't fall down. It scythes from left to right, then from right to left back again, cutting the sky. It is actual glass. And this beautiful brutality is what makes the planet look so blue. So for HD189773b, although it might look like the most glorious planet to visit, should we ever get to travel that far through space, it should probably be last on your wish list. It'd be like taking a holiday to a paper shredder. So, what I love about science, right, is that it's always asking questions. There's loads of stuff that we don't know, but science is always trying to find out. It uses genius bits of technology and weird ideas to try and get the answers. And sometimes, maybe to save the world. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, this week, we're tackling a problem that is threatening the very planet that we live on. Peter Curler is from the charity The Plastic Tide, and he's here to tell us more about what's really going on in the ocean. Peter, hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, hi everyone.
So, spell it out for us then. How bad has this problem really got in the sea?
It's gotten pretty bad. So, I think the last quote we thought there were 5 trillion pieces of plastic in our ocean from all kinds of sizes. Because some scientists have done some more estimations, and we think that is now an underestimate. So 5 trillion pieces, that's probably more grains than grains of sand on a beach. It's incredible. It's scary.
Isn't there the statistic that as humans and scientists, we only know about 5% of what's in the ocean anyway?
Yeah.
There's about 95% that's completely unknown to us.
Yeah.
So maybe the problem's going even further. So why is this happening? Why is all this plastic floating around our ocean? And a lot of people, apart from charities such like yourselves, aren't doing much about it.
See, I think we're only just starting to understand the problem now. I think we just haven't known about it before. I think some research has been going on, and it's only now that the big picture is dawning on us, and it's a result of the way we live. So we see plastic in everything we do. I mean, and if you look at what you do, whatever you're touching now, even your phone is made of plastic. And it's not to say that we need to get rid of all of the plastic. It's just how we manage it. That's the problem. And I think a lot of science is sort of pointing to that direction, that mismanagement means that it spills into the ocean. Maybe, you know, if you throw a piece of litter on the ground, the next rainstorm that comes along, it could get washed into the ocean via a drain. So if people aren't careful with what they do with their litter, there's a very good chance it will end up in the sea.
What happens to it when it's in there? Why is this such an issue?
So when it gets into the sea, it breaks down into tiny, tiny little pieces of plastic called microplastics. But even before then, when it's in large pieces of plastic, like, for example, fishing nets, ropes, strings, what happens is it can look like food to a lot of animals. So a lot of marine animals will come and try and eat it. So, for example, I think we've all seen on Blue Planet 2 the whale playing with a bucket. Now, we're finding that a lot of whales and larger mammals washing up on beaches have stomachs full of plastic. We see a lot of seals entangled in ropes and plastics because they play with it, they toy with it, because they're naturally fun animals. They like to play with things, inquisitive.
How bad can this get? So right now there's all these tiny little bits of plastic floating around. What can the long-term damage to the Earth be?
So, and this is why it's so important. It's being covered by British Science Week and why we're trying to get so many tags in on this. But we only have one ocean, so it's not like your phone. You can't go and buy a new one. You can't change the ocean. These trillions of tiny pieces of plastic are almost impossible to remove, right? So what can happen is that it can build up to levels where it gets stuck in fish, and fish will eat it. Then we eat the fish, and so we're eating our own rubbish. Quite literally, we're eating our own rubbish, and we don't yet know what damage that can do to us.
So you're the founder of the Plastic Tide, a charity that's looking to help this problem. How are you starting? What are you doing right now?
So the biggest thing is that when it enters our ocean, 99% of the plastic is unaccounted for. What started with me is I went to the South Pacific and I saw firsthand the plastics that are affecting these in the very remote islands, thousands of miles away from major cities. So when I understood the problem more, I could see that we needed to monitor that plastic. We need to detect, we need to identify where it is, and only then can we sort of trace it back and say, okay, well, that's a big source. You know, if we're getting lots of bottles in of certain types, then we know that that's almost like a tap, if you will, that we can turn off on land to stop all of that plastic getting into the sea. So before it even gets into the sea, we can prevent it through this work that the Plastic Tide does through tagging plastics online. But also, it can help make beach cleans much more targeted and make sure that we can identify the hot spots on coastlines where plastic litter builds up. So if ever you see any litter on the beach, please clean it up. And if you can't get to the beach, then you can log on online to theplastictide.com and then click our target link. Our new target is 1 million pieces. So we're looking for 1 million tags. And each one of those tags trains a machine learning algorithm or a computer program to find plastics by itself automatically. So if you imagine we can send out thousands of these digital eyes all over the coastlines to find the plastic for us and to tell us how much is building up and where. And through that, we can generate this global picture of the plastic problem in a way that we've never been able to do before. And all of it depends on people tagging the plastics to train the computer program.
And is this where drones come into the mixture? I've heard some talk with the Plastic Tide and drones. Is that what's going on?
So what we do, we get a drone, and it can be any drone that you can buy off the shelf. You do need to make sure you've got the proper license and the permissions to do it. But you can fly to a beach and you survey the beach. And then when we're done, we upload those images to the Zooniverse platform, this tagging platform that I've just been telling you about. So all the little images you see in that platform on that website are from our drone. And we've also starting to bring in images from other drones around the world. And eventually, when we've tagged it all, we then the algorithm would automatically be able to find the plastics in any of the images taken from any drone.
How can we make sure the problem doesn't go further? What can we do that's not technological? We don't need to go online to do it.
Yeah.
What can we do right now to stop plastic getting into the ocean to cause any issue?
So you right there, you have, on sitting on your desk, you have a reusable water bottle. That's number one. If you drink coffee, if you're old enough, you can get a reusable coffee cup. Reusable items, simple things like that are very easy to do. You can ask your mum and dad. It saves you money in the long run. There are more and more refillable water fountains cropping up in London. Don't flush anything down the toilet that isn't natural. Any wet wipes say it's flushable, it's not. Because they don't break down, they're made of plastic. And you wouldn't think they are, but they are made of plastic. And it says flushable, but they're not flushable.
Then where do we go? So the Plastic Tide, where can I go online? Where can I tag things for you? Where can I be the 1 millionth person?
You can go to www.theplastictide.com, and you log in there, and you'll see underneath, you'll see a tag it button. Click on that tag it button, and it'll take you to our tagging website. Or you can follow us at The Plastic Tide on Twitter, or The Plastic Tide on Facebook, or at Vision from the Skies on Instagram. Also check out the British Science Association website. We've always publishing stuff about how we're doing and our progress, and thanking everyone. And tell us what you're doing as well. If you're tagging, please let us know, and let us know what you find, if you find anything cool.
Well, there's so many ways there that you can help save the world, like almost exactly. Quite literally. Peter, thank you not just for coming in and telling us that, but you've made me feel very smug as well with my reusable water bottle. So I'll go and tell everybody that now. Peter Curler, thank you so much from the Plastic Tide for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you, everyone.
So let's get back to another dangerous Dan. So we just looked at the most deadly thing in space. Now we're headed back to Earth, into nature, to look at the Black Death. And today, we're headed into Africa to meet a huge, deadly beast that's got a nickname which tells the whole story. You see, the Cape buffalo lives in sub-Saharan Africa, just under the desert. And when it's left alone, it is pretty chilled, really. Just, you know, huge herds of the buffalo. They roam from watering hole to watering hole, just trying to have a drink, get some food, and maybe survive. But if they're threatened or if they're wounded, it's like the buffalo get some angry superpower. They get a split personality. They become like the Hulk of the plains. And they become what people call Black Death. These buffalo, they're about 6 foot tall, which is probably as tall as your dad is as well. They weigh close to a ton, and when they feel in danger, they've got a very particular way of dealing with it. They circle their prey, and then they charge, head down, poking their two enormous horns through the sky. They speed at about 35 miles an hour at whatever is threatening them. There's hardly any chance to move out the way, and there's hardly any way you can survive either. The Black Death is responsible for killing more humans who are hunting them than any other creature. More than lions, more than tigers, more than hippos, and it's all to do with two enormous spiky horns and some relentless running. It's time for another science expert on the show, a proper genius. And this one is telling us what happens when two of the most amazing creatures in the world are mashed together. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, a 180 million year old fossil could hold the key to a missing link in evolution. It's like something from a film, get this. It's a crocodile with a tail of a dolphin, and they found it. And Mark Young is a paleontologist at the University of Edinburgh. He joins us on the show. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
So, Mark, everyone right now, when I've said a crocodile with the tail of a dolphin, is probably imagining something that would slip nicely into Jurassic Park. But from what you understand about it, how much is it like dinosaurs that we've seen in the film? Tell us more.
Well, the specimens are typical crocodiles. I suppose the tail looks a bit more like a shark tail bent downwards rather than horizontally like a dolphin. And it doesn't really look like anything in Jurassic Park. Perhaps the large mosasaur that was in the last two Jurassic World films would be the closest thing to a specimen.
So tell us more about croc dolphin then. Where did it come about? Why have we suddenly found this?
Well, the specimen helps us learn about a group called Micturinkids. And Micturinkids were a sort of dolphin-like, sort of shark-like group of crocodiles. They lost the body armour, the hands became flippers, the hind limbs became sort of paddle-like, and they evolved this shark-like tail fin. And they've been known for almost 200 years, actually just more than 200 years. They were named before any species of dinosaur. And they're known for quite a lot of the world, all across Europe, South America, even into Russia. But exactly where they came from and how they evolved into these weird dolphin-like animals, we've not really been sure. And this specimen from Hungary is helping us to figure out the link between crocodile-like fossil crocodiles and these more dolphin-like forms.
So tell me about the science of it. We've been kind of calling it croc dolphin. Tell me about what it actually is and what we know about this missing link now.
Well, the species is called Magdiarosuchus fetosi, and it's named after the person who collected it. And Magdiarosuchus means the crocodile from Hungary. It's approximately 180 million years old, so it comes from the early Jurassic. And it helps fill in the time gap between these dolphin-like forms that evolved about 170 million years ago and the more crocodile-like forms are 182, 185 million years old. So it's right bang in the middle of this gap in the fossil record.
So we're using crocodile and dolphin, kind of animals to compare it to.
Yes.
Were these dinosaurs back then anything actually like what we know as a crocodile or dolphin?
There was nothing really like a dolphin back then. Mammals were quite small, maybe the size of a cat, up to the size of a dog. So there was no really marine mammals. All the large marine forms were reptiles, so crocodiles, ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, pliosaurs. So crocodiles, the first crocodiles evolved about 230 million years ago, but they were terrestrial and built more like a greyhound than a crocodile.
More like a greyhound?
Yeah, quite lists. The limbs would be held under the body. They were terrestrial. And it wasn't really until a mass extinction event cleared away all the semi-aquatic reptiles. The crocodiles evolved, become semi-aquatic and crocodile-like, as we would recognise it today.
So what has this missing link told us about why it's evolved that way? What do we think came first? Is it the crocodile and then it then grew the tail? Why would it do this? Just expand a little more about the evolution, if you can, Mark.
So one of the interesting things about the fossil is that it has very well-developed body armour of a crocodile, but the tail flick, the tail fin, and it suggests that these tail fins evolved while the crocodiles were still quite heavily armoured, so quite a rigid body, which is quite unusual, because we assumed that the heavy body armour would have been lost first, and then they evolved tail flukes and flippers. But it seems that some of these other forms of the tail fin may have evolved first. So it seems like some of these animals were living in quite deep water, like maybe like a saltwater crocodile today, and over time they've become slightly more marine adapted.
So why exactly would they do that? We know that evolution is all about survival of the fittest. It's about seeing an opportunity, and then random mutations let you take advantage of that. Why would it grow this to help it cope more with the ocean?
Well, it would probably be for propulsion, so it would be more efficient swimmer, more an efficient swimmer. As modern crocodiles keep the limbs held close to the body, and sort of almost like a wave goes through the body from the trunk all the way down to the tail. A more efficient type of swimming is to hold the body rigid and just move the tail. So the tail fin sort of helps with propulsion. So perhaps it's the beginning of a more efficient type of swimming.
Now, Mark, you're a paleontologist, so I am hoping that you know loads about all forms of dinosaurs. Are there any other missing links that we need to find? Fossils that you're hoping that we can dig up, you know, crazy dinosaurs that we maybe have an idea of, but we don't actually have the proof yet?
So my group's mainly crocodiles and marine reptiles rather than dinosaurs, but for dinosaurs there's still quite a lot of confusion about which group of dinosaur is closely related to others. So over the past year and a half, some big papers have came out that suggest that the early evolution of dinosaurs is in flux. So we don't know where the meat-eating dinosaurs are more closely related to. So some hypotheses say it's these long-necked sauropods. Others say it's the more ductile dinosaurs. So hopefully at some point people will find the very early dinosaurs and they can help tease out exactly how dinosaur evolution started and which groups more closely related to what.
Is Hungary quite a popular place to find fossils? I mean, if you go to the Jurassic Coast just down south here in the UK, you find an abundance of the things.
Yes.
I've never really heard of dinosaurs creeping up on the shores of Hungary before.
Yeah, there's not that many, and most of them are from the late Cretaceous. So this fossil from the early Jurassic is actually quite rare. I didn't realise it at the time, but it's actually quite a famous fossil over in Hungary. So it's quite an honour to get to work on it.
Brilliant. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly to tell us more. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
So we've gone all over the place this week with our catch-up from 2018 with our best dangerous stands of the year. We've gone out in the universe, into nature, and now we're going into ourselves to find out what happens when we laugh ourselves to death. It's time for today's Dangerous Dan, all about the most mean, deadly and evil things in the universe. And this week it sums all three of those up, because we're looking at the laughing sickness. Kuru is an extremely rare disorder that was once common among the four people who were a tribe that live in the island of Papua New Guinea, which is in the ocean, Australia way. And Kuru, it causes your nervous system, so that's your brain, your spine, your nerves that go all around your body, it causes them to wither away. And while they do that, while they're withering, some kind of strange things happen. You get body tremors. Every part of you shakes uncontrollably. Your muscles start to do their own thing, which means your legs, your arms, they'll be firing themselves around. You can't swallow, you can't stay awake either, and then the most strange symptom comes. Uncontrollable fits of laughter. You just spasm with hysteria. You can't stop cackling. You're laughing like a hyena. Or maybe have you just seen your dad trying to squeeze into a tight pair of jeans after eating one too many Easter eggs. That's why they call it the laughing sickness. Now, its strangeness doesn't stop there, though, because the disorder... This is quite gross. Brace yourself. The disorder is caused by cannibalism. Because the four people, when one of their tribe died, they would cook and they would eat the body out of respect. So it was this celebration, this tribute to the dead, that caused Kuru the laughing sickness. So that is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen and for getting in touch with us all year. I hope that you'll be with us in 2019 as well. If you've got a proper smart genius science question that you want answered by an actual expert in 2019... let me know. You can do that by leaving it as a review over on the iTunes podcast store. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there. Drop us 5 stars. Leave your name as well so I can say hello. And then in the little comment box at the bottom, leave your question. Also, while you're on iTunes, it's one of the best places that you can catch up with all the brilliant science series that we do on Fun Kids. You've heard some of them today. We've got loads more of them on there for you. You can also find them on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a kids radio station from the UK. You can hear us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. I'll see you next year. Bye!
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station, Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.